If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
But what the paintings display is a man of a rather rare compassion, not just a great general, but somebody who could sympathise, who could empathise with his troops.
That was Alan Forrest on Napoleon's propaganda painting.
What's very interesting about the cult of Mussolini, I think, is the way in which people bend over backwards, almost instinctively, I think, to try and give him the benefit of the doubt.
And that was Christopher Duggan on Fascist Italy. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast with me, Rob Attar. This podcast is brought to you by the team behind BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. You can find it in all good newsagents and on subscription. Plus, we have a Kindle edition available on the Amazon website and an iPad edition on the Apple newsstand. And we've also recently launched a Kindle Fire edition, and that's available on the Kindle newsstand. You can find out more details of our digital issues, plus great subscription offers on our website, which is historyextra.com. If you have any comments about the podcast or anything else that we do, you can get in touch with us through email, podcast@historyextra.com, on Twitter @HistoryExtra, or on Facebook /HistoryExtra. In this week's episode, we're discussing two pivotal figures in the history of modern Europe, Napoleon and Mussolini. Our first interviewee is Professor Alan Forrest, an expert on Napoleonic France. He's written a feature for the Christmas issue of BBC History magazine about Napoleon's use of propaganda in words and pictures. The magazine's publisher, Dave Musgrove, caught up with him to delve a little more deeply into Bonaparte's character and cultural leanings.
The main point that you're making in the feature is that Napoleon is famous as a general, principally. That's what most people would associate him with, but you think that we should also recognise him perhaps as a man of culture and propagandist. So which of those is correct? And perhaps you should just explain to us why you think that's the case.
Yes, it's a good question. I came to this really when I started writing a biography of Napoleon and realised that there were different narratives that were being told. One, a very powerful one, by himself and by his supporters, and that he started essentially a long work of propaganda very early in his career. Was he really interested in the arts? I'm not sure. He went along to operas in Paris. He appeared to be excited by art exhibitions. But there was also a very strong degree of self-interest. He used artists, as indeed modern politicians have been known to do, in order to win over public opinion, in order partly to persuade public opinion that he wasn't just a general or a man interested in politics, but that he was also a consummate son of the Enlightenment, interested in world cultures. Was he really interested? I don't know. He read quite a lot of history. he compared himself at various times to Charlemagne. As an educated man of the 18th century, he had read quite a lot of the classics. He was seeped in the literature of his time. He wasn't an ignoramus, but whether he was really interested in art for art's sake and whether he had any aesthetic sense is more difficult to judge. He certainly understood the value of art to him in terms of winning over his own population.
So let's go sort of back maybe to Napoleon's early years. Is there any evidence that you can see in the character of the man that was of a cultural bent? Was it, as a young man, did he show any interest in culture as far as you can ascertain?
He is alleged to have read very deeply and very widely when he was at military academy in Brienne. There is a representation of him that makes him appear quite scholarly and actually quite solitary in some ways. It's difficult to tell. What we do know from the early years is that he does seem to have read quite a few of the more radical Enlightenment authors of the 18th century, and that he himself dabbled in a certain amount of what you might call rather sort of juvenile philosophy. It wasn't very profound stuff, but it followed in the lines of Rousseau and the other philosophers whom he'd read at the time. He also, as I say, read the classics, and he started that fairly young. And later, when he travelled Europe as a general with his army in the field, one of the rare and interesting things about Napoleon is that he takes a little library along with him, and he does seem to read, including works of history and works of classical literature, at night as he's on campaign. So I think there is a certain side to him that is genuinely cultivated and genuinely interested in the arts, whether any more so than a person of his class, minor aristocracy in Corsica, in the 18th century would be expected to be, I don't know. I mean, he reflects his times fairly accurately, I think, in that way.
And you just described him as a son of the Enlightenment, so would you kind of expect him to be of a cultural bent, given what was going on in the background in European society and culture?
Well, it was the second half of the 18th century. People read not just the great authors of the Enlightenment, but a rather more popularised, vulgarised, if you like, literature that came out of it. There were lots of pamphlets doing the rounds, pamphlets attacking authority, of course, attacking clerical authority. And Napoleon seems to have read some of these and to have contributed to that sort of general trend in writing and reading. Would I expect him to have done, possibly, as a young aristocrat, he would have had the opportunity to do so that would have been denied to others. But, of course, many would have been deeply conservative, would have rejected that kind of literary approach. He does seem, in his early days, to have been curious, interested, impatient, and as a result, fairly radical. Impatient with the social constraints, the glass ceilings he couldn't break through, but also, I think, impatient in his own career in the army, that there were aristocrats who were being promoted simply because they were the sons of aristocrats, and he was determined to get where he was going to go on merit. So there is an element in Napoleon that is fairly left-wing, if you like, in the 18th century context, someone who would be quite likely, for instance, to welcome the French Revolution in 1789.
The other aspect of culture in Napoleon is this propaganda element. And I think you say in the feature that he had a rare flair for publicity and propaganda. So how did that manifest itself then? Can you give me a few examples of what you mean by that?
Yes, he is quite deliberate about it. there's nothing left to accident. I mean, for instance, under the Revolution in general, it was quite common to inform members of your regiment about the achievements of the army by running a small newspaper that would simply circulate among the troops. Napoleon did that. But what he also did was he hired some of the best journalists of the day, and there were plenty around in the post-Jacobin period, people who'd been very exciting journalists in Paris in 1791, 2, 3, who'd been discarded for one reason or another in the course of the decade. One or two of these accompanied him to Italy, and they were sending back copy for newspapers in Paris. He wasn't only circulating his troops and his army, that was one audience that he considered very important. But the second audience, and perhaps the more important audience, was the general public, the political class in Paris. And from a very early period, he is quite deliberately using that press to create opportunities for himself. It's not brutal publicity. In some ways, it's extremely well done. He doesn't praise himself all the time. He praises the soldiers. He praises their commitment, their bravery, their sacrifice. But then at key moments, like, for instance, just before Brumaire, when the plot was being hatched in Paris by Paul Barat and others to stage a coup d'etat, to overthrow the Directory and to come to power, Bonaparte was a conspirator, and a few days before the Brumaire revolt, the insurrection, suddenly the tone of his press changes, and it becomes focused almost entirely on him, on his swift actions, on his incisive nature, on his brilliance, his fleet of foot. That wasn't left to chance. It was the use of propaganda, I think very intelligently, not just to bloat his own ego, but actually to manipulate the political situation. And I think there's something very modern about that, in a way. I mean, kings, in a sense, had always been propagandists. Heads on coins, equestrian statues in public squares and so on. There was an element of the use of art and imagery and representation for propagandist purposes, which is there with all regimes. But Napoleon is doing this as a humble army officer. And how much more clearly does he do it when he comes to power and when, as emperor, he can actually command these things rather as kings could do. I'm not saying he imitates kings entirely. He does things rather differently. His audience is also slightly different. But he does it with a great deal of aplomb, and he uses the best people around him. For instance, getting a key figure to run the Louvre, to bring in artistic collections, to display these before the French people. I mean, all that is done as well as a reflection of the emperor's great interest in the arts and culture.
And you mentioned that he hired journalists.
Yes.
What do you mean by that? He paid them to go on campaign with him?
They accompanied the army. And yes, they were, in a sense, answerable to him. He was using them as a conduit to the Paris press, because they had the contacts and the connections with the main newspapers in Paris. And he was conscious, it seems to me, in 1796 and 1797, that this was a political role as well as purely a military role. I mean, after all, this is a general in Italy who wins a number of fairly rapid, quick-fire victories at a time when politics at home in Paris is deemed to be rather boring. It's not too difficult to capture the headlines and to become, if you like, the key figure of the moment in many people's eyes. Add to that the fact that at Campo Formio, he, as the general in the field, drew up the treaty with the defeated Austrians without actually referring it back to the government in Paris. This is a man who oversteps the powers that have been given to him from time to time, but does it very calculatedly, and already clearly has the ambitions for political leadership as well as for military leadership. It seems to me quite an interesting case, an early case, of a man in a political system which is not stable in the 1790s. If you think of a number of regime changes that have been since the beginning of the French Revolution, of adapting himself remarkably well to that politics of the day.
Going back to propaganda then, and beyond the words aspect, Napoleon also used images.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, when I say he used images, he, to some extent, hired artists. He encouraged artists to paint particular moments of his career which he thought were noteworthy. And so you get some very clear and rather heroic images coming out of the Italian campaign, for instance. The artists of the day are, I think, in a little bit of a bind. how can I best explain this? Under the Ancien Régime, what did artists do? They accepted commissions. They painted portraits of aristocrats and other people. Well, that market had disappeared. The revolution replaced that, really, with public commissions for art. They held exhibitions at the Salon every 2 years. They began to set themes that artists might like to compete, almost for prizes, in a particular area. So Bonaparte was able, in a sense, to benefit from the fact that they were being encouraged to paint patriotic themes. Bit difficult to do political themes, I think, because politicians come and go, and it can take 6-9 months to do a major historic painting. If you chose the Girondin, then there could be a Jacobin government by the time you'd finished. And people tended to eschew these subjects, whereas military subjects were safe. They were patriotic campaigns. And he was a very photogenic general who, in a way, created propaganda from that situation. I mean, to give you a couple of examples, there are some wonderfully handsome paintings by David and others of Bonaparte on campaign. There's a very famous one of him on a great white charger crossing the Alps. You don't cross the Alps on a white charger. You probably cross them on a donkey, which is possibly how he got there. I mean, the painting is not a realistic representation of what happened. It is a deliberately heroic image. And there's a lot of heroic imagery being encouraged by Bonaparte in this period. Once you move on to Egypt, it's even easier. You've got pyramids and palm trees and Mamelukes in exotic uniforms. There's something... It's one of the same time heroic, and it's exotic, and it's slightly orientalist, and it appeals greatly to the romantic imagination of the time. And once he's emperor, of course, he can to some extent control the themes of the salons. And so he is essentially, or the state is, but it's the same thing, commissioning painters to paint the great moments of his career. So you get voluptuous paintings of his coronation as emperor in 1804. You get battle scenes from Austerlitz and Jena, and more controversially by Gros of Eylau in 1807, where he actually dares to portray dead bodies on the battlefield. That's unusual. You get pictures of Napoleon as a man of great compassion, going to pardon the Egyptians at the gates of Cairo, for instance, or Napoleon comforting his own troops in the hospitals in Jaffa, the plague hospitals, at the end of the same campaign. Now, these events may or may not have happened. If they happened, they happened once. He also allegedly ordered that large numbers of his troops who were too sick to come home and who risked falling into the hands of the enemy should be slaughtered and should be shot rather than risk the humiliation of being taken prisoner. So, I mean, there's a bit of Napoleon that is actually quite cruel, some would say quite barbarous, at certain moments. But what the paintings display is a man of a rather rare compassion, not just a great general, but somebody who could sympathise, who could empathise with his troops, who spent the nights in the bivouac with them, who shared their miseries. Well, again, yes, sometimes, but not that often.
So it's quite easy to see what's in it for those artists once Napoleon's in power, and why they would display him like that. But prior to that, what was in it for them? Was it financial reward? Did they think that Napoleon was the coming man and wanted to sort of back him up? Or was Napoleon sort of browbeating them and saying, and demanding copy approval and that sort of thing?
Well, I doubt if too much browbeating was needed. I mean, the heroic battle picture is a sort of standard form of history painting and had been under Louis XIV and the rest. They were powerful images, and Napoleon, perhaps the army more generally, would wish to encourage these. The Directory itself may have paid for some of this. If you go back a bit further, the more difficult it becomes to find a reason other than that painters were looking for subjects for canvases. If you take someone like David, for instance, during the 1790s, he is a Jacobin, he is a revolutionary painter. He possibly has 50 or 60 people in his atelier in Paris, so it really is quite an operation. And David was a kind of court painter to the revolution. But history paintings, battle paintings, are part of that. It's part of the celebration of the regime and the victory of the regime. So I don't think the fact that David would paint Napoleon in 1796 and 1797 as he did necessarily indicates that he was doing anything else than continuing to record the great moments of the history of the Directory. David himself, of course, changes cap very easily and becomes the leading painter at Napoleon's court as well. So he is simply, possibly, the leading history painter of his day who adjusts to the demands of the moment. Was he a Jacobin? Yes. Was he a Bonapartist? Well, later it appears, yes, he was perfectly faithful, perfectly loyal. There's no hint of satire in the way in which he presents Napoleon as emperor. And of course, there are people who will say that actually there was no great caesura in 1799, that Napoleon did inherit a lot of the ideals of the French Revolution and didn't betray them all. I mean, he betrayed some of them. He went quite clearly by dressing up as a king, his marriage ceremony to Marie-Louise, in which he virtually took word for word the marriage ceremony of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. There are some things there which are clearly anti-republican. But if you look at the Napoleonic Code, for instance, he takes a lot of the new laws that have been introduced individually in the 1790s and codifies them. And he imposes that on every country that France invades in the 1800s. So there was a lot of continuity. And I think for someone like David, it would be possible to convince himself that there was no necessary betrayal involved in moving from support for the revolution in the 1790s to support for the consulate and then the empire thereafter.
So, coming to a conclusion, we're sort of building up a picture here of Napoleon as a man keen to portray himself as a man of culture. We're not entirely sure whether he truly was a man of culture, but keen to portray himself as a man of culture and keen to make sure that he was in control of his image and that people were saying the things that he wanted them to say about it.
Yes.
So he must have been particularly riled by caricaturists, particularly British caricaturists, portraying him in an entirely opposite light, an unflattering light. What was his response to that? Do we know?
Anger, I think. You're quite right. There's an enormous amount of caricature, of cartoon illustration in this period. Britain is not the only country that indulges in it, but it probably is the country where the art is most refined. There are German cartoons, there are Russian cartoons, there are, of course, French cartoons in this period. And they portray Napoleon differently, but apart from the French ones, usually with deep, deep disdain. It's interesting that, I mean, for Gilray and for Rawlinson and the others, there was no single figure in the Revolution who represented France. You don't get Robespierre being portrayed as the figurehead, the representative of France. Now, suddenly, it's a blessing for the cartoonists. They have a man, they have a figure whom they can use, just as they had used kings to represent foreign governments in the past. Quite interesting. They don't portray him as being ugly. In fact, he's, on the whole, slim, rather dapper, rather handsome, but totally untrustworthy in the way in which he is portrayed, at least in the early days. And then, of course, when the years of victory give way to defeat in the peninsula, to the Moscow campaign, to Leipzig, from 1810 onwards, 1811 onwards, it does tend to be a downhill slope. The caricaturists are celebrating. By 1813, most of his German allies have joined Prussia and Austria to form a coalition against him. The Battle of the Nations at Leipzig is the outcome. So suddenly, countries where cartoons had been quietly, carefully, modestly favourable are producing vindictive rhetoric. English cartoons, which are portraying him by this time as virtually a war criminal or a caged animal, these are being reproduced joyously around Europe, with obviously different languages imposed upon them. By 1814-15, he is quite often a figure of hate and of fun. I mean, his response is one of anger, of course. He likes art, and I include opera and the musical arts, to represent the mood of the moment. And the mood of the moment changes. There is the pomp of empire. There is Napoleon, the European monarch, on a par with, perhaps above, monarchs in other countries, which is the image in 1810, 1811. And then by 1815, when he comes back from Elba for the Hundred Days, it's then that you start getting the new image, the Liberty Caporal, the man of the people who'd risen through talent in the army. He's very, very conscious of the importance of image at a particular time. And the image that the cartoonists are presenting, of course, is one that he finds defaming and unacceptable.
Okay, last question then. So he seems, it's a word we use a lot today, is legacy. I don't know if it's a word that was in common parlance then, but, you know, people in power worry about their legacy. Sounds like he would be worrying about his legacy. So if he was alive today, what would he think about the way he's portrayed by historians like yourself?
Oh, it's a very good question. He spent a lot of time on St. Helena, when admittedly he was given a lot of time to spend, with a small number of friends, Lacaze, Marchand and others, much of it talking about his own career. And it's quite clear that one of the things he was doing was actually preparing his destiny. You could say he'd been doing this for quite a long time, but he was preparing explanations. He was talking about the Italian campaign in grandiose terms. He was trying to explain away the Russian campaign and Waterloo. Yes, he was deeply, deeply conscious of his heritage. What was that heritage? Well, over the 19th century, of course, it was very dispersed, including adulation, people who believed he had Christ-like qualities, people who talked about the Second Coming, some wonderful poems of Béranger, which peasants in rural France loved, which looked forward to the day when he would rise from the grave on St. Helena and come back to be among his people on the banks of the Seine, which in a kind of a way, of course, he sort of did in 1840, it was the return of the ashes. What would he make of historians since? I think it depends on the historians. If you look at France, there is still a strange fascination with him. For a long time, he didn't do too well in university curricula in France, but that's partly, I think, because modern history ends in 1790 when the archives end, and contemporary history does tend to begin in 1815. So there is a kind of interlude into which Napoleon drops. And with the interest in the history of culture, and indeed with the longue durée, the history of trends across time, which became so important with the Annales school, then the sort of histoire événementielle, the event after event, became deeply unfashionable, and Napoleonic history, I think, fell out of fashion. There is a certain amount of vituperation towards him. I mean, among some English historians, there is an attitude of contempt towards him, which has not disappeared. But it's rare in France, I would have thought. What you do find, I think, increasingly, is a willingness to try and theorise this period. If I take Michael Brough's work, for instance, I mean, looking at empire as a form of colonialism, looking at the differences between inner empire and outer empire, and yes, looking at empire rather than the emperor, looking at the regime he built, his achievement, if you like, rather than purely the biography of the man. I'm not sure that Napoleon would have agreed with Mike, or with me, that his achievement was actually the achievement of his generation, rather than purely the achievement of one single individual. But he might have been interested that 200 years on, we are still speaking about him. That would probably have caused him a great deal of content.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
That was Alan Forrest. Alan's latest book is a biography of Napoleon, published by Quercus in 2011. And you can read Alan's piece on Napoleon and propaganda and see some of the images discussed in the Christmas issue of BBC History magazine. Christopher Duggan is Professor of Italian History at the University of Reading. In his latest book, Fascist Voices, he analyses diaries, letters and other sources to discover how Italians really felt about Mussolini and the fascist regime. I interviewed him not long ago about his research and to find out whether Mussolini genuinely was a popular leader. Just to begin, could you please give us a bit of background on Mussolini? So when did he come to power in Italy and what was the nature of his rule there?
Okay, well, Mussolini came to power at the end of October 1922 after several years of turbulence in Italy, economic turbulence, political turbulence. His own background was that of a revolutionary socialist. In 1912, he came to national prominence as really the leader of the revolutionary socialists in Italy. But the First World War had led to a change in his political outlook. He'd become somebody who favoured intervention in the war, and that had set him on a path of political drift in a way. And after the First World War, he wasn't quite clear what direction to go in. And he became head of this movement, as it initially was, the movement, fascist movement. But it wasn't quite clear what that movement was, but gradually took on a rather strong anti-socialist and anti-communist character, and gained a huge amount of support in the north and centre of Italy. And on the back of this sort of ground root support, he was sort of swept to power with the March on Rome in late October 1922. So he came to power, in a sense, on the back of a sort of surge of turbulence and sort of revolutionary activity among his rank and file followers. But he was actually appointed constitutionally by the king. So in the first years of power, it was a sort of strange government in that it was, on the face of it, constitutional, normal government that was setting out to restore stability in Italy. Yet there was this sort of rumbling in the background all the time among his grassroots supporters pressing for a kind of revolution. And it's ultimately that sort of revolutionary surge that caused a change in direction of the government in 1925 and led to the establishment of what became the fascist regime.
So was it only in 1925 that this becomes a dictatorship?
Yes, in a sense. I think it was pretty clear to quite a lot of observers already in 1921-22 that the fascist movement, or fascist party as it became in 1921, was pretty uncompromising in its dislike of liberalism, democracy and parliament in Italy. So it had a pretty intransigent revolutionary outlook. But I think, a lot of the older liberals rather hoped that they could tame this sort of revolutionary element in the party and steer it into constitutional channels. And it was only on the 3rd of January 1925, after Mussolini went into Parliament and challenged Parliament to impeach him effectively for all the violence that had been perpetrated by the fascist party, and Parliament and the king did nothing. Only at that point did it really become a dictatorship, and that led to the sweeping away of opposition parties, all other opposition parties, in 1925-26.
So although it was a dictatorship, is it fair to say that it was to some degree a popular dictatorship?
Well, I think there's, yes, undoubtedly. I think, first of all, we've got to bear in mind that the liberal parliamentary regime in Italy had really, for many, many people, become thoroughly discredited by, well, in many ways, by the First World War. There have been decades of criticism about liberalism in Italy as something that wasn't really suited to Italy. It led to unstable governments. It had not helped to check the rise of socialism, to revolutionary socialism in Italy. So there's a long-standing feeling in Italy that parliamentary government simply wasn't working. That was accentuated after the First World War with the introduction of universal suffrage and proportional representation, which led to a paralysis in parliament. So by the time Mussolini came to power in 1922, there's a pretty strong feeling in many quarters that parliamentary government wasn't working, and fascism was able to capitalize on that. And when it became a dictatorship from 1925 and clamped down on press freedom and so on and so forth and abolished opposition parties, I think, you know, many people said, well, okay, these are sacrifices, but, you know, compared to what we had before, this is considerably better. It's got stability. And more than that, what Mussolini set out to do was to create a sense of excitement around fascism as something that was new, distinctive, something that was sort of represented Italy in a way that liberalism hadn't done, and could mobilize Italians in ways that the liberal parliamentary regime hadn't done. And he was able, in particular, to reach out to the Catholic Church and to get a conciliation with the Catholic Church in 1929, though the support of the Catholic Church had been there almost from the start. So he was able to actually draw people into the regime as it became after 1925 and secure, I think, very large measures of popular support.
And this was even in spite of the more unsavoury aspects of the fascist regime, for example, the violence that was perpetuated by them.
Yes, I think, yes. I mean, it's interesting to see, for example, what, you know, people like the very distinguished philosopher and historian Benedetto Croce, who was arguably Italy's most famous international intellectual, who from 25 became a fairly outspoken anti-fascist. But if you look at what he was saying between 1922 and the end of 1924, you know, he was bending over backwards to give the benefit of the doubt to Mussolini and fascism on the grounds that, you know, Italy needed sort of injection of new blood. It needed to improve on what happened before. So people were, you know, saying, okay, the fascism is regrettable, but you know, maybe it's necessary in terms of rejuvenating Italy, creating a stronger, healthier political system, a stronger sense of national identity. So I think people put the violence in the scales and said, well, regrettable, yes, but, you know, maybe necessary. And you know, the fear of socialism was also, you know, extremely strong in 1919, 20, 21, 22. And so, you know, for many people, say, well, okay, violence, yes, but if it resolves the problem of the threat of revolution, maybe, you know, we just have to put up with that. So, yep, I think a lot of people, you know, weighed up the violence in the scales and said, well, on balance, something we just have to, you know, tolerate in some way.
And how much would you say that fascism's popularity came down to Mussolini's own personal appeal?
I think hugely, hugely. I think if you look at the history of the regime from 1925 onwards, there is, you know, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the fascist party in particular, and that dissatisfaction grows in the 1930s. The fascist party is seen as a vehicle for placemen. It's very extremely corrupt. A lot of dissatisfaction with the party. There's dissatisfaction with various aspects of fascist policies. Though I think also a lot of satisfaction as well. I mean, the economic policies, you know, with hindsight, it may seem that many of the economic policies of fascism were a bit hollow, particularly the idea of the cooperative estate, which was much trumpeted in the 1930s, but in practice it didn't seem to achieve very much. But there's a lot of hope, I think, that fascism would be able to achieve things that economically other countries couldn't do. And certainly it seemed as if Italy was wearing the weathering the storm of the Great Depression of the late 20s, early 30s better than many more industrialized countries. So, you know, I think even though the economic record of fascist regime was not great. I think many people felt that it was actually better than many other countries. So, you know, a lot of the policies were popular, the public work schemes, the welfare schemes, all these things. But at the end of the day, I think it is really Mussolini and his personality and what he seemed to stand for Italians that really held the regime together. Not least because it was ideologically a little bit diffuse and you know, wasn't quite clear, you know, precisely what fascism stood for. But you know, the common denominator was Mussolini, and that's what people, I think, emotionally responded to in particular.
And did Mussolini himself understand that and exploit his own sort of personal charisma to try and boost fascist popularity?
Yes, I think he did. I think, I mean, initially he seems to have been somewhat sort of reluctant to allow himself to be sort of paraded as this demigod. But I think increasingly from 25 onwards, he knew that the cult of his personality was going to be absolutely crucial for the regime. And so the party and many intellectuals and so on worked to build him up from 25 into this sort of providential figure. The church also played a huge role in this, and Mussolini to a large extent went along with it, and I think was quite happy to develop his cult and see it as absolutely crucial to the regime and its success.
Now, I know that in Britain many people, particularly by the time of the war, saw Mussolini as quite a pompous, almost buffoonish character. Did no Italians view him in that way as well?
Well, I think some did, certainly. I mean, you can look at the diaries and letters of intellectuals, and I think a lot of them were well aware that Mussolini was in many ways, you know, perhaps a rather comic, perhaps rather absurd figure. Though many also sort of tempered that by saying, well, maybe he's got something absolutely extraordinary about him. Maybe he is a sort of genius, despite all the sort of apparent crassness and crudity of his style and so on. But I think what... You know, for a lot of the more reflective people who supported fascism, you know, for what they saw was somebody who was able to, you know, pull the country together, unite the country, and give it a sense of, you know, international standing, perhaps, and you know, make it a force in the world. And you know, compared to what happened before the First World War, when Italy had seen very much the least of the great powers and been rather ignored on the world stage. You know, for many of them, this was something new, and therefore, you know, even though they could see all the absurdities in some ways of Mussolini's style and his rhetoric and so on, nevertheless, they could see that, you know, it did work in terms of binding together, in particular, the mass, the population, to the state in a way that had not happened before. I mean, this was, you know, the sort of gap between the mass, the population, and institutions had been seen as the great besetting weakness of liberal Italy. Here was somebody who, you know, for all his faults as a human being and for all his absurdities in many ways, was able to actually engage emotionally with millions and millions of ordinary people. And so, you know, intellectuals and the more reflective you know, elements in the population say, well, okay, you know, so be it, it's good.
Now, clearly the Second World War was a defining moment for the fascist movement of Mussolini. At the start of the war, were they still as popular, Mussolini in particular, as he had been earlier on in his reign?
Well, this is difficult. The sort of received wisdom is that Mussolini and the fascist regime reached the pinnacle of popularity with the Ethiopian War of 1935-36, and that thereafter, with the growing friendship and soon alliance with Nazi Germany, the introduction of racial laws in 1938, that the regime and Mussolini began a fairly rapidly descending parabola towards you know, hostility and opposition. I think it's more complicated than that. I mean, it's certainly true that there was a great deal of disquiet about the friendship and soon alliance with Nazi Germany, great deal of disquiet about that, and great deal of mistrust of Hitler and the Nazi regime. There's also a lot of bewilderment at the racial laws in 1938. And other measures such as the so-called reform of customs. But against that, I think there was a sense, for example, among intellectuals that fascism really needed to become a little bit more radical and perhaps a bit more sort of hard-edged. I think there was, among particularly younger intellectuals in the late 30s, there was a sense that, you know, fascism hadn't really achieved its ideological goals, its political goals, and needed to become a little bit more hard-edged, perhaps a bit more like Nazi Germany. So I think among intellectuals, there's really quite a lot of support for some of the more unpleasant reforms, or what seemed to us more unpleasant reforms, late 1930s. And among mass of the population, well, great disquiet about what, you know, where Europe's heading. But at the same time, I think tempered by a sense that, all right, Mussolini's delivered up till now. He's got a, you know, he's a huge success in Ethiopia. He's done great things. He seems always to have made the right choices. And, you know, all right, war with Nazi Germany could be awful, but at the same time, it could bring, as the phrase has it, peace with justice, which for many ordinary Italians meant a better share of the world's resources, an end to the domination of Britain and France, the plutocratic democracies, as they were called, and, you know, finally a chance for Italy to become a serious world power with a serious empire of its own. There's a lot of talk about the decline of the Western democracies, which was not just, you know, there in Italy or Germany. Many countries, I think, were concerned about decline of, you know, the state of democracy in Europe in interwar years. So I think, you know, a feeling that, you know, big risk, you know, getting involved with Germany, a huge risk getting into the war, but maybe, you know, this could be the beginning of an even more glorious period for Italy.
You mentioned earlier that quite a few Italians were a bit concerned about the growing relationship with Nazi Germany, but as mm-hmm. Hitler, in a way, was modelled on Mussolini, why were they worried about a rapprochement with Germany?
It's a problem of an expanded Germany. There's the issue of Austria, and therefore bringing a bigger Germany right down to Italy's northern border. There were German-speaking groups within Italy's own borders in the South Tyrol. So there were issues about, you know, just how far Germany would go and what kind of threat it might pose to Italy itself. But, yes, I mean, coupled with that, a sense that, historically, there had been quite a lot of mistrust of Germany. I mean, Italy had been an ally of Germany from 1882 down to 1914, and it had been a very uneasy alliance. Gain a sense that Germany's ambitions in Europe were perhaps a little bit too great, and Italy might end up being overshadowed. So I think, quite a lot of scepticism about Germany's ambitions, and, you know, even after the war broke out, feeling that, okay, Italy was an ally of Germany, but would Germany really respect Italy and allow Italy to remain fully independent or to have its own share of, say, southern Europe? So a lot of uncertainty, I think, about the German alliance.
And you mentioned that up until the start of the Second World War, Mussolini still retained quite a high degree of popularity. So was it really the military reversals in the war that finally turned Italians off Mussolini?
Well, they certainly started to, I think. But what's very interesting about the cult of Mussolini, I think, is the way in which people bend over backwards, almost instinctively, I think, to try and give him the benefit of the doubt. I mean, because it is the sort of, like, the sort of point of coagulation for the regime, people create an extraordinary myth around Mussolini as somebody who was, unimpeachably honest, that he was a great patriot, a man of genius, a man of providence, as the church said, and that he was not to blame for what was going wrong. Even after the extraordinary reversals, military reversals in Greece, for example, from the autumn of 1940, disasters in North Africa, people often didn't blame him. They said, you know, this is because, unfortunately, he's got around him corrupt advisors, incompetent people. It's interesting to see in diaries and letters the extent to which people say that Mussolini is basically a victim of people like the much hated Ciano, the foreign minister. Of course, Mussolini appointed him, and he was his son-in-law. But it is extraordinary to see how, they say, people want to protect Mussolini, the image of Mussolini, and see him as somebody who is there still as the point of hope at the top of the regime. And particularly interesting to see that the more desperate things become in 1942 to 1943 in particular, that you get extraordinary letters from being written to him, in which, you know, they sort of pledge themselves even more fully to him and saying, "I believe in you, we will win, you know, you are the best thing in Italy, and I'm sorry you've got these dreadful advisors, but you know, you're our salvation."
So when the fascist Grand Council did then decide to depose Mussolini, would that have been actually quite an unpopular step for the general population?
Well, not unpopular in the sense that by then I think people were desperate to get out of the war. By the second half of 1942, it's pretty clear, I think, that Italy had made the wrong choice in going to war with Germany, and that Italy was going to end up on the losing side. The aerial bombardments by the Allies of Italian cities in particular were causing huge problems. People were having to clear out of the cities. Italy hadn't got proper air defences, and the morale in the cities in particular was declining rapidly in the course of 42 and early 43. So I think there was a widespread mood in much of the country, particularly in the towns, but also to some extent in the countryside, please, let's get the war over and done with, let's get out of it. And so Mussolini is deposed on the 25th of July and arrested and replaced by Marshal Badoglio as Prime Minister. There's a huge outpouring of popular excitement and enthusiasm, a lot of smashing of portraits of Mussolini and so on and so forth. Though I think much of the mood then, the euphoria that sweeps across the country, certainly in the big cities, particularly in the cities of northern Italy, is one of excitement that peace is now going to be coming. And of course, that was an illusion.
And so when Mussolini was then reinstated by the Nazi regime, did he retain any of his old popular appeal, or was it clear to everyone that he was just a puppet by this point?
Well, it was fairly clear, I think, that he was a puppet, but that, I think, fed into these ideas that Mussolini is a victim. So, you know, that in some ways, that could help those that retained faith in him. Yes, I think there were plenty of people who, you know, still believed in Mussolini, or still wanted to keep faith with the faith that they'd had for the best part of 20 years. We get, quite a lot of people who make a choice after the armistice is declared in September 43 to go and pledge their support to Mussolini, the Republic of Salò, when it set up in the early autumn of 1943. Yes, it's faith in Mussolini. It's faith in fascism. It's also a sense of honor. There are a lot of people who feel that what Italy did in between July and September 1943, in going against its ally in Nazi Germany, was dishonorable. This idea of honor was acutely felt by many who had served in the army and felt that what Badoglio and the king had done was dishonorable. So I think there were quite important strands of support still for Mussolini between 43 and 45.
Although obviously there must have been a fair tide of anger against him, particularly considering the way that he was eventually executed by Italians.
Yes, I think so. I think there is undoubtedly in many, many quarters a sense of anger, of bitterness, a sense of having been let down, been led astray. Yes, I think a very complicated mixture of feelings, which came out in the rather grotesque scenes in Milan on 29th of April 1945, when Mussolini's body is strung up from the gantry of a garage along with his mistress and other leading fascists, people spitting on the corpses and urinating on it and so on. A really, really extraordinary scenes, but I think a real amalgam of anger, of hatred, of dismay, but maybe also a sense of self-loathing at having pledged themselves for so long to a man who later turned out not to have been the demigod that many thought. But at the same time, there were still plenty of people around, I think, who still thought that Mussolini was a great man who'd been betrayed and was a victim in 1945, whose memory deserved to be kept alive.
And what you're doing with this book is potentially challenging quite a cherished myth among many Italians that they, generally didn't support fascism to that extent and were quite happy that Mussolini was ousted. Do you think it's going to attract a lot of controversy in Italy?
Well, it'd be interesting to see. I think there's been a feeling for some time that ever since, I suppose, the sort of late 70s, that there was a sort of, I mean, consensus, to use the word, that's probably not very helpful, but it's been used for quite a time by historians, that there was consensus around fascism. But I think a lot of the talk about so-called consensus has been linked to discussions about the structures that fascism put in place to mobilize people. What hasn't been explored, what I tried to do in this book, was to try and get inside the minds of ordinary people, certainly those people, and there were millions of them, who cheered for Mussolini and cheered with genuine enthusiasm, and see what it was that redrew them to Mussolini and drew them to fascism. So I think what will probably seem problematic is the sort of picture of emotional intensity that surrounds fascism and the ideas of fascism and the idea of Mussolini, and the intensity with which people identified with certain aspects of the regime and identified with Mussolini. I think the extent to which I would suggest that fascism is able to map itself onto so many aspects of Catholicism and derive emotional charge from that I think will be problematic as well. But I think it seems to me pretty clear that for many, many Italians, fascism made sense because of a lot of the imagery language of Catholicism. I mean, fascism made a huge thing about the importance of faith and obedience and hierarchy and authority, opposition to materialism and liberalism and socialism and so on. All these things resonated strongly from a Catholic perspective, and I think helped to give fascism its emotional charge. So I think the book's going to be controversial probably from a number of aspects, but particularly I think in suggesting that there was a real emotional impetus behind fascism, that the degree of consensus didn't simply come from people being mobilized through structures, through party organizations and so on.
And I suppose because people in Italy were living under a dictatorship, is it possible to genuinely sort of get to what their real feelings were? Would people have been perhaps scared to express their real disappointment or dislike of the fascist regime because they were worried about what might happen to them?
Yes, I mean, there's been huge debates among historians about whether you can talk about public opinion under totalitarian regimes generally, because clearly there wasn't the space for people publicly to voice discontent, opposition. The press was controlled. There weren't public debates and so on and so forth. I mean, there were public debates actually, but not in the way that we would accept as being free. So there are difficulties in terms of public opinion, which is why historians tend to say, well, you can't talk about public opinion, but let's think about popular opinion and can we assess popular opinion under totalitarian regimes? Methodologically, there are difficulties here because what are the spaces? I've used diaries, a few hundred diaries, a lot of letters. Well, there are issues here too. I mean, how free do people feel to write in letters or in diaries what they genuinely felt? Letters, of course, could be subject to censorship, were subject to censorship, so that was a bit risky. But diaries are more interesting, I think. And, there are obviously various reasons why people kept diaries, and you can't see them as simply a mirror of people's inner thoughts and feelings. They could be, but sometimes people kept diaries, for example, with a view they might be published or be read by somebody else. But I think they're not a bad source for getting into the hearts and minds of ordinary people. We certainly get indications that people at times, particularly in the war, were a little bit concerned about keeping diaries just in case they fell into the wrong hands. So there were risks involved. But I think what I would have expected, and it's a bit surprising I didn't find more of them, I would have expected there would be more diaries in which people who were really uncomfortable about the regime and want to take their distance from it, I thought they might have kept more diaries. And in fact, we've got very few diaries of people who use a diary as a vehicle for expressing their discontent with the regime. There are some, and some most famous ones have in fact been published. But in general, I think the diaries that I've seen are diaries of people who wanted to offload their feelings and their thoughts. And the great majority of them indicate, I think, that as far as the regime is concerned, they engaged with it in various ways and supported it. So I think it's an interesting source. And it's one way I think we can, and this has been done also for the Soviet Union, for example, quite a lot of interest there in the use of diaries to try and get inside the minds of people under Stalin, see what they really felt and thought about the regime. So I think it's a good source, but obviously it's only one source and it's limited to people who could write, and so that's going to exclude those many millions of people in Italy who are not particularly literate or who are completely literate. So there are problems, I think.
You mentioned just then about the Soviet Union. Do we have any indication of how popular something like Italian fascism was compared to other regimes, such as Stalin in Russia or Hitler in Germany?
I think it's very hard to gauge these things any objective way at all. I think, well, one quite revealing thing, I think, is to look at the letters that were written to Mussolini and letters written to Hitler. Recently, I think about 5 years ago, a German historian published a collection of the letters that were sent by ordinary Germans to Hitler. These letters had been taken away by the Red Army from Berlin in 1945 and hidden in Moscow, wherever it was, and been discovered 5 or 6 years ago by a German historian. Yes, selection letters were published. They've been published recently in English as well. But I think what's quite revealing from my perspective about those letters is that the sort of rather measured way, very often, that people wrote to Hitler in very different terms and very different tone to the way they often wrote to Mussolini. There's also a quantitative difference. Suggested Hitler received perhaps 1,000 letters a month from supporters, whereas in the case of Mussolini, he was getting about 1,500 letters a day from ordinary Italians in the 1930s. And the letters he gets are extraordinary in the sort of passionate, almost religious sort of language that people use. So, and I think, you know, Italian fascism places huge emphasis on ideas of faith, enthusiasm, and so on, and people are encouraged to relate to Mussolini in particular in terms of enthusiasm and faith. And so we see the sort of, you know, the pictures of cheering crowds and so on in Mussolini. A lot of that is deliberately encouraged and orchestrated by the regime, and I think reflects an important, quite important element, quite distinctive element in Italian fascism, in that it tried to generate passion and emotion among ordinary people, but perhaps to a greater degree than in Nazi Germany or Soviet Union. But I say it's very hard, I think, to quantify in any serious way levels of enthusiasm or support between one regime and another.
And just taking things forward to the present now, how is Mussolini viewed by Italians in the 21st century?
I think in very mixed ways. Because after 1945, Italy became a republic, and it was a republic that was founded on, at least as far as the constitution was concerned, on the values of resistance, on the values of anti-fascism. But Italy had no systematic purge, and indeed, overtly, a neo-fascist party was set up at the end of 1946, even though the constitution, which came into effect in 1948, said it was against the constitution to in any way continue or to celebrate the fascist party. And I think one of the problems with Italy was that the values of anti-fascism were upheld most strongly by the Communist Party, less strongly by other parties. And one difficulty with that has been that once communism was discredited at the end of the 1980s and 1990s and the Communist Party disappeared from Italy, this has opened the way for the right, particularly sort of Berlusconi and his allies, to try to discredit anti-fascism by saying that anti-fascism was essentially synonymous with communism. Communism is discredited, and therefore one could suggest that anti-fascism should be discredited as well. And there's been quite a strong campaign ever since the early 1990s to discredit anti-fascism, to downplay the importance of the resistance, to suggest that there was morally no difference, for example, between the partisans on the left in 1943 to 45 and those who supported Mussolini still in 1943 to 45 and fought for the Republic of Salo. And we've got people like Berlusconi, but other prominent politicians as well, quite publicly making very positive remarks about Mussolini. Berlusconi, for example, about 10 years ago, did an interview with the Spectator newspaper in which he, you know, he said jokingly, you know, Mussolini never killed anyone, and that you know, the standard punishment under fascism or confino of internal exile was just a holiday camp. But that's part of a whole series of very sort of positive messages that have been made by senior public figures in Italy about fascism. It's led to really quite remarkable levels of tolerance for sympathy and support for Mussolini and fascism. Just give you one example, which rather shocked me when I discovered it this summer. Probably the most notorious of all fascist generals, celebrated by fascism as a sort of embodiment of the fascist new man for his ruthlessness, Manco Rodolfo Graziani, was responsible for many of the most brutal aspects of the military campaigns in Libya and Ethiopia in the 1930s, and again during the Second World War, and the general who was put in charge of the armed forces in northern Italy in 1943 to 45, and was found guilty of war crimes after the Second World War and sentenced to 19 years in prison. They actually served two. This summer, his hometown near Rome inaugurated a memorial park to him at public expense with a large monument to Graziani. And the celebrations were led, amongst others, by a Catholic priest who did a commemorative speech to Graziani. So I think that's symptomatic of how there are these strands of sympathy and support and rehabilitation, if you like, of fascism still lurking around in Italy. They're strands, they're certainly, you know, not necessarily very widespread, but I think what is, you know, a little bit disturbing, I think, is the extent to which people in quite senior positions in public life can feel that it's quite acceptable to say positive things about fascism and Mussolini.
That was Christopher Duggan. Fascist Voices, An Intimate History of Mussolini's Italy, has been published recently by Bodley Head. Christopher wrote a piece on Mussolini for the December edition of BBC History magazine, which you can still get hold of as a back issue and also on the iPad. And that's about all for this episode. Do join us next week when we'll be having our annual Christmas quiz, so make sure you have your brains switched on for that one. And don't forget, our Christmas issue is out now in the shops with stories on the Anglo-Saxons, Napoleon and the Mayan apocalypse. The History Extra weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by Dave Gibson.